You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi.
And I'm Katie Frankowitz. Astoria leaders are moving forward on two key pieces of a new Shelter First policy intended to address homeless camping downtown. The Shelter First policy was presented by City Councilors Andrea Mazzarella and Elizabeth Adams at a recent meeting. It came out of months of discussions and several stalled attempts at other approaches. On Tuesday, the City Council held a first reading of an ordinance to amend Astoria's current camping code. The code will now state that it's illegal for people to camp knowingly on public property if they have access to reasonable alternate shelter. The amended code adds that whether the shelter is actually reasonable has to be determined on a case-by-case basis. Under the amended code, if someone violates the camping code, they could face fines of $35 and risk being trespassed from the area for 72 hours. The amended code also provides for some exemptions to how people comply based on their individual circumstances. City Manager Scott Spence explained.
For example, it is possible that maybe someone is, there is shelter available, but maybe they have a pet and then that shelter does not allow that. That is potential discussion we're going to have to walk through legally to see if that is a reasonable barrier to entry into shelter. So that would be an example of something like that. In terms of an exemption, so obviously we have time, manner, place restrictions or standards for our public spaces. It is conceivable if someone is in a wheelchair and they have an inability to pick up every night or meet those time restrictions, then again, we will work on a case-by-case basis and then we provide a temporary exemption or permit so they would not be in violation of those time, manner, place standards.
City Councilor Adams noted it will be hard for the city to anticipate why someone may not comply or be able to comply with the city's camping code.
And that is why this plan and this initiative is so important to have all of the components together that lean on each other. This ordinance leans on the liaison so that we can have that one-on-one contact. And it's important for us to think about this as the entire plan and not just these individual pieces, because none of them are going to be achievable without the other parts.
So on Tuesday, city councilors also authorized staff to move forward on a homeless liaison position. This contracted position would be focused on daily interactions with people experiencing homelessness in Astoria to help them navigate services and to coordinate with other social service agencies. A primary focus of the work is to move people towards shelter. The liaison would try to help people comply with the city's camping code, but they will not be responsible for enforcing the code. City councilors and some members of the public said it was important to them that the liaison position be separate from police activities and oversight. The position will report to the city manager's office, but Spence says there will still need to be ongoing communication and coordination with the police department. The city has tentatively budgeted just over $60,000 for the liaison services. With the council's approval Tuesday, city staff plan to publish a request for qualifications for the position to begin recruitment. I'm Katie Frankowitz, reporting for KMUN.
Updated election results in Tillamook County show minimal changes. Incumbent Tillamook County Commissioner Mary Faith Bell remained ahead in her bid for re-election against businessman Jeff Spink. A measure seeking to form a new fire district that would cover the city of Tillamook and Bay City remains on track for approval. Leonard Ingalls, Kathy Baker, Casey Burden, Tim Hamburger, and Jeff Hoffert were leading vote winners in the race for the new district's five-member board of directors. The race for Tillamook County Circuit Judge tightened slightly, with Matthew Leon in the lead over Alex Hamilian. Voters with challenged or absent signatures have until June 9th to cure their ballots ahead of the June 15th certification deadline. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com.
The city of Seaside says a strong odor in neighborhoods near a wastewater treatment plant is not a cause for concern. Officials say the odor, reported yesterday, is caused by more concentrated wastewater as the plant transitions from winter and spring conditions into summer conditions. The odor impacts are stronger some years, depending on flow levels, weather, wind directions, and plant conditions. They say that reduced capacity in part of the treatment plant's aeration system is also affecting the odor issues this year. The city is in the process of replacing aging equipment that helps circulate air. That work is expected to continue through the summer. For now, city staff are attempting to reduce the odor. They are beginning the second week of what is typically a 2 to 3 week stabilization process. A separate second odor concern remains ongoing at the intersection of 12th and Holiday, where a major sewer lift station helps move wastewater through the sewer system. Seaside City officials say they're working on plans to improve that lift station, but this is a major infrastructure project, and the city will not have a construction timeline until a scope of work, cost estimate, and funding options are further developed. Off the Washington coast, the Trump administration has removed 3 high-tech ocean monitoring stations. The National Science Foundation is planning to remove similar research buoys off the Oregon coast near Newport later this month. Joe Schumacher is a fisheries biologist with the Quinault Indian Nation.
They've taken hundreds of thousands, not millions of dollars of equipment, put it in warehouses where it's going to rot. I don't know if you know this, but ocean equipment doesn't do very well when it's taken out of the water and put up in warehouses. It's just a travesty in that regard alone.
The tribe's fleet of Dungeness crab boats relied on the buoys for local weather and wave reports. Managers used the data to cancel crab fisheries when underwater oxygen levels dropped low enough to kill the crabs. The removals are part of a national dismantling of data buoys in the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. A spokesperson for the National Science Foundation says the federal agency is committed to ocean science, but is shifting its support to other scientific priorities. You're listening to News on KMUN.
Scientists and students are making the most of a funding delay affecting the PacWave project off the Oregon coast. KLCC's Brianna Bowman reports on the water from the Pacific storm.
On a cool and still May morning, biology students from Oregon Coast Community College walked past the familiar chorus of sea lions on Newport's bayfront and boarded OSU's 84-foot research vessel.
All right, good morning, everybody. My name's Kevin. I'm going to be your captain today.
This field trip is part of Oregon Sea Grant's STEM at Sea program, which gives rural high school and community college classes the opportunity to go to sea with scientists. Tracy Cruz with Oregon Sea Grant says they'll get to be part of the action as members of the science party for a day.
They will be out there helping to collect the data and sort through the samples, and so it's really that hands-on component.
On this particular day, students helped collect seafloor sediment samples at the PacWave South site, located about 7 miles offshore directly west of Newport. PacWave is a unique wave energy converter testing project. In 2024, 4 cables were buried in the seafloor sediment stretching from the facility in Waldport to the PacWave site. No converters are currently installed due to a lack of funding flowing to developers from the U.S. Department of Energy. That isn't stopping researchers. Sarah Henkel is an associate professor in the Integrative Biology Department at OSU. She's tasked with monitoring the potential impacts of installing the cables and other project infrastructure on the seafloor ecology.
I have been taking seafloor samples of the site and the surrounding areas since 2013, and now we are doing our post-installation sampling to see if we can detect any changes from the physical installation of the cables.
On deck, over the hum of the Pacific Storm's diesel engine, Henkel gave a briefing about what the class was going to be doing as a part of the scientific crew that day.
A sample of sediment off the top in a small jar, and we will use that, take that back to the lab, and measure the grain size of the sediment. And then there will be a bucket underneath.
Henkel noted that the very thing that makes PacWave a great location for this kind of testing, large, energetic ocean waves, also means the seabed is used to a highly dynamic environment.
Any sediment disturbance that might have happened from digging the trench and then pushing the sediment back in is probably on the scale of what these seafloor critters experience with a winter storm.
While this type of sampling requires a large vessel to deploy the sediment-grabbing device, known as the box corer, the process itself is relatively straightforward, making it an ideal hands-on introduction to the world of marine science for students.
Oh, it's coming in. Oh, worm.
Who was it?
Got it.
Long boy.
Hunched over the sieve in groups of three or four, they used forceps to break apart chunks of clay and mud. Henkel is fascinated by the variety of sediment she finds in this area.
You know, if you garden here on the coast in your yard, you've probably got one patch that's like perfect soil, and then you're like, ah, there's all this clay and gravel, like, you know, just a couple paces away in your yard. And so you got to remember, like, it's the same thing out here, right? It's just a continuation of the land.
The students carefully looked for anything that might be alive, had once been alive, or might contain life, like a shell. Some creatures, such as bright red worms, stood out immediately. Others, like teeny tiny clamshells, were easy to overlook at first, but before long, the students' eyes became trained to spot them. But that wasn't all the students saw. Selena Harris had her first experience ever seeing a whale.
When I saw it, my jaw just dropped to the floor. Like, it's just, you know, I'm one of those people that's a thrill junkie. But, you know, roller coaster could not ever amount to seeing a whale in the wild.
The crew collected 15 samples over the course of the day. Instructor Sam Loftus noted the importance of giving students these kinds of hands-on opportunities.
And part of why I think coming out on these trips is really important for them is somebody on this boat today might be a worm ecologist and didn't know it until today.
What do we find in here?
Couple of brittle stars and sea cucumbers.
On the way back to port, there was a sense of relief for some as the ship returned to calmer waters. Some of these students were happy to be back on land, but for others, this might just be the start of a passion for ocean science. In Newport, I'm Brianna Bowman reporting.
Soccer fans are flocking to Seattle this summer to watch 6 World Cup matches. The international soccer tournament has been years in the making, but this isn't the first time countries from around the globe have sent some of their best athletes to Seattle. KNKX reporter Mitch Borden takes us back to the 1990 Goodwill Games, where nations came together in the Pacific Northwest to help ease Cold War tensions.
On a bright summer day in July, thousands filled the University of Washington's Husky Stadium for the welcome ceremony of the Goodwill Games.
Welcome to Seattle, host city of the 1990 Goodwill Games.
Athletes from dozens of countries landed in Seattle to compete for gold, silver, and bronze medals during the 17-day event. On YouTube, you can watch the sports stars waving to fans before facing off in track, ice hockey, swimming, and so many other competitions. Talk show host Larry King did the broadcast.
Countries competing are Argentina, Australia, the Bahamas, Brazil, Bulgaria, Canada.
This was all taking place at the tail end of the Cold War, so the United States and the Soviet Union were the stars of the show. The event was the brainchild of the late Ted Turner, the media mogul known for creating CNN. He was inspired to hold the Goodwill Games after the U.S. boycotted the Summer Olympics in 1980, and the Soviet Union skipped the 1984 Olympics.
And so he decided what he wanted to do was launch an international sporting event that featured the Soviet Union and the United States in new ways to actually bring the world together rather than tear the world apart.
Gretchen Sorensen was a spokesperson for the Seattle Games. This was only the second time the event had ever been held, and its first time in the U.S. It was a huge investment. An Olympic-sized pool was built in Federal Way, and a new track was installed at UW. Still, the Goodwill Games didn't catch everyone's attention, which Sorensen found out firsthand.
So I called all my friends, and they'd say, oh, do you want me to send you my old clothes? And I'd go, I'm not going to work for Goodwill. I'm going to work for the Goodwill Games.
Organizers had to convince skeptical city and state leaders that inviting the Soviets to Seattle was a good idea. Kathy Scanlon was on the Goodwill Games organizing committee. She says their pitch was fairly simple.
This is a moment in time where Seattle can shine and we can all learn more about these people that have been our traditional enemy.
As the event approached, newspaper headlines proclaimed excitement and concern. If you didn't know better, some of them could have been about this year's World Cup. Rising measles cases, faltering ticket sales, and potential traffic jams. Art Thiel was a sports columnist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer at the time. He says the Goodwill Games didn't approach the magnitude of a World Cup or the Olympics, but it had its moments. Specifically, the men's 100-meter dash.
This is the most anticipated race of the Goodwill Game. Carl Lewis, Leroy Burrell.
We're at I don't think Seattle will ever host an Olympic Games. And this was as close as Seattle did and will get to the vibe of an Olympics.
The race was a duel between two of America's best sprinters, 29-year-old Carl Lewis and 23-year-old Leroy Burrell. Thiel says the magic of this event is seeing the peak of human speed. One moment, runners are standing still. The next?
It's a good start.
It's a burst of energy, an economy, and a power of motion that is almost unimaginable, and they're all separated by half a second.
Leroy Burrell!
Burrell beat out Lewis, finishing the 100-meter dash in just over 10 seconds. Thiel says one of the reasons sporting events like the Goodwill Games are special is that they unite people.
To have the world get together and agree on rules and values, morals, it's just such a rare thing.
Ted Turner's Goodwill Games ended up being short-lived. The year after the Seattle Games, the Soviet Union collapsed. The Games were held a few more times around the world, but in 2001, organizers finally called it quits. Still, Thiel thinks it's worth remembering.
The Games will always have a place in Seattle's sports history. Fades with time, but you don't want to ever forget about one-of-a-kind moments.
Now, with the World Cup on the horizon, Seattle's preparing for another historic moment. I'm Mitch Borden, reporting.
This is KMUN.
Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN news team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A federal judge ruled May 29th that New Hampshire's 2024 proof of citizenship law, intended to stop a microscopic non-citizen voting and voter fraud threat, created a significant burden to eligible voters and violated the U.S. Constitution. Prior to HB 1569, New Hampshire required citizenship information at registration, but allowed eligible voters who didn't bring a birth certificate or U.S. passport to legally attest to citizenship using a qualified voter affidavit. HB 1569 repealed the affidavit and required documentary proof, often not readily available or affordable to many voters. Expert testimony in the case found that between 1998 and 2024, only 8 non-citizens may have cast a ballot, resulting in a 0.00031% rate of non-citizen voting. 5 of those voters were registered through a poll worker's error, not fraud by the non-citizen. In comparison, over 10% of voter registrations from April to November 2024 used the qualified voter affidavit to attest citizenship, almost 15,000 voters. In a 98-page opinion, Judge Samantha D. Elliott ruled that the repeal of the qualified voter affidavit created a burden for those voters under the First and 14th Amendments. We've linked to the decision at American Democracy Minute. I'm Brian Beal.